I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. Lots of movies have a hero, that flawless person who always saves the day and for the right reasons. But what about the anti-hero, the tarnished and flawed characters who emerge heroic in spite of themselves? The DVD gurus are back, and today we'll look at the traditional idea of the Hollywood hero and explore how it has changed since the middle of the 20th century. We'll talk about how movies like The Searchers and A Fistful of Dollars changed the way moviegoers thought about them. Listen in, we'll talk about L.A. Confidential, Man on Fire, Donnie Darko, and more. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Up to Date, I'm Steve Kraske. There are heroes and villains in the movies, and then there are the anti-heroes, those tarnished and flawed people who wind up doing the right thing, though sometimes for the wrong reason. Think Clint Eastwood in A Fistful of Dollars. Think John Wayne in The Searchers. Our DVD gurus are here to talk great anti-hero films, and they include L.A. Confidential, Man on Fire, Donnie Darko, and a whole lot more. Well, the DVD gurus are screenwriter and UMKC film professor and writer for 435 South Magazine, Mitch Bryan.
Great to see you, Steve.
Nice to see you, Mitch. And Jason Heck, movie reviewer for Inc. Magazine. Hello, Mr. Inc.
How are you, bud?
All right, good. Well, let's define our key term today, gentlemen, the anti-hero. What are we talking about exactly?
Mitch Bryan, classic anti-hero.
I was thinking Steve Steigman.
Steven Steigman, show
producer,
showrunner,
the man who often does the wrong thing for the right reasons.
Actually, we had a pretty good discussion about this, and my classic criterion for the anti-hero were people who actually do selfless things for selfish reasons.
There you go.
So there are people who sort of end up making other people's lives better, but that's not necessarily what they set out to do in their movies. Whether they will accomplish some broad, wonderful goal, but they'll really do it because they're trying to accomplish something very small and personal. So, hey, I saved the president's daughter, but really I was just trying to get out of prison or something like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of how Mitch and I have led our lives.
So selfish reasons.
Sure. Selfish reasons. Look at one of my favorite indie heroes is Snake Plissken, from John Carpenter's Escape from New York. And, he doesn't. He ends up sort of saving the world or destroying it, depending on how you read the end. But he's really doing it because he has two tiny little explosive charges that are going to blow his neck open in 24 hours, and he just wants those taken care of. These antiheroes, a lot of them are career criminals in the movies that we're going to be looking at. They're not really good people. They just end up kind of doing good deeds.
Yeah. Mitch Bryan, is there an actor who's regarded as the great Hollywood antihero?
Well, the interesting thing about the antihero is it seems to have appeared in American cinema sort of after World War II, initially with some of those film noir movies where you had these tarnished heroes who maybe because of what they had seen in the war and they had sort of their naivete, their innocence had been lost, and they come back to a world that they realize, is not nearly as beautiful and sweet and innocent as they thought it was. And then by the time – so certainly with John Wayne in The Searchers, that he's one of the archetypical anti-heroes, this guy who is so driven by hatred. He hates Indians and he's determined to sort of wipe as many out as he can, and he ends up trying to find a girl who's been captured, and raised by a tribe of Indians, and you're not sure whether he's going to kill her or take her home when he finds her. Then by the time you get to the 60s – when the production code was starting to loosen up and some films were coming in from overseas that didn't have to sort of function by the same rules as the American Hollywood picture, you get the man with no name, Clint Eastwood, playing this very enigmatic character who clearly shoots first and asks questions later and seems to be on the right side of things, but you're never completely sure because he doesn't seem to be a particularly kind, warm and fuzzy guy,
So prior to the anti-hero, then films were pretty much black and white in the sense there were good guys and bad guys, not a whole lot in between.
Right. I think if you look at classic Bogart detective stuff, You know, if it, and you know, Mitch has looked at sort of the literary origins of some of this stuff. Dashiell Hammett, these guys were not necessarily the cleanest of detectives. They were guys who would generally do the right thing, but they would, you know, bend a few rules. They would call in favors. They would apply pressure. So if you look at the classic Maltese Falcon, at the end of it, you know, Bogart is got Mary Astor, and he said, you know, he's really enjoying turning her over for the crimes, and he's actually laying it all out, and the only thing he really says to sort of ameliorate all that pain that he's inflicting on her, he's saying, you know, I'll be waiting here if you get out of Tehachapi, unless they hang you by that sweet neck. If they do, I'll always remember you. The only thing he says to really kind of lighten that pain is, all we have is maybe I love you and maybe you love me, and that's it. This is a guy who, you know, he's kissed her. They've gone through hell together. And at the very end, he can't stand that his code's been broken, that he's been set up, that she has done all this damage because she's so greedy. And he turns her right over with the understanding that she's probably going to be hanged for her crimes.
Mm-hmm.
That's, to me, is kind of an origin story for anti-heroes in the mm-hmm. movies. I think, yeah, after the war, with the rise of film noir, it was a lot more pain was being seen in the American psyche, and it was easier to throw it up there on the big screen. But I think and that's when you get stuff like sort of Dix Haley in the Asphalt Jungle and kind of anti-heroes like that. But for me, it really started with kind of detectives in 30s and 40s stuff.
So anti-heroes are people who do selfish things for selfish reasons, you're saying?
Selfless reasons.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Okay, there we go. That's our definition of our show today, anti-heroes. Let's go to our list here first. Jason, you're up first with The Crow.
Yeah, our major undead anti-hero today. The Crow is this ferociously stylistic and beautiful debut from an Australian director named Alex Proyas, who went on to magnify it and make it even better in his follow-up, a film called Dark City. It's also the film that Brandon Lee, Bruce Lee's son, was filming when he was killed.
Wow.
He was shot by what was supposed to be a blank firing gun and fragments of a bullet that had been lodged in the barrel punched into his abdomen.
No
kidding. And he died 12 hours later. It's based on a graphic novel by an artist named James O'Barr, but the movie was written by two guys who are actually not real famous screenwriters, but they're horror authors, John Shirley and David J. Shaw, who are kind of knee-deep in a genre of horror called splatterpunk, which is generally very violent and very gory. The movie is very violent. We have Devil's Night in Detroit, which is traditionally the night before Halloween and used to be Detroit would erupt in arson, hundreds and hundreds of fires, people burning down. You know,
I'm a Detroit native. I remember those nights well.
Did you throw a Molotov yourself there?
I was in the middle of that stuff for years.
Did you put the fires out or did you start them, big guy?
I was too little.
Bless your heart.
But I was headed the wrong way. Thank God I got out.
It took Steven Steigman to get you out.
Yeah.
What we have is Eric Draven, played by Lee, is a rock musician, and he is and his girlfriend Shelley are murdered by a gang in their apartment. 1 year later, a crow lands on his tombstone, pecks on it a few times, and he emerges from the ground, frightened. But
that's all
essentially,
it takes. A couple of pecks from the crow, and out you come.
The crow is his conduit to the spirit world, and it grants him invulnerability, essentially, because he's already dead, so he can't really be hurt, and immense skill with martial arts. So he decides to avenge his wife's death. And goes on a campaign of violence against a gang consisting of T-Bird, Tintin, Funboy, Skank, and their boss, Top Dollar, who is played by...
And you read those names off without even looking down at your list. Are you amazing or what?
I'm a big fan of Skank and Top Dollar. They were actually names I was considering for my guinea pig. Top Dollar is played by Michael Wincott, who has arguably the greatest voice since Yul Brynner. The movie is everything about film noir amped to the nth degree. It is the city itself are these beautiful model cityscapes, so it has a kind of phony comic book look to it. It's sort of something that was drawn on later in movies like The Matrix and Sin City, but this is kind of the origin, and it did it on a smaller budget. These really incredible point of view shots of the crow as it flies through these gorgeous models, and you know, every building is dilapidated and everything is covered with rain. And the movie essentially takes place over one night. There's some stuff that happens on Halloween night, but it essentially takes place over the course of Devil's Night. And we have Eric Draven coming back and connecting with a little girl that he and his wife used to take care of because her mother's a druggie, and connecting with the cop who tried to investigate things and see what happened to him and got busted down to patrolman. But it's actually a really the action is beautiful. The movie itself is gorgeous to look at, and has a lot of humanity and a lot of heart actually at the center of it. The scenes with Lee, of course, have extra poignancy knowing about his death. You know, the movie
Who are those gang members again? Take those names off.
Tintin, Fun Boy, Skank, T-Bird, and their boss, Top Dollar.
And he said it looking me right straight in the eye, not looking down at his notes. Boy, that's impressive.
Well, it's like how you know the president's name without even looking at your notes because you write about politics. You know, if you look at it long
enough, exactly what
it just stays in your head. So, you know President Obama's, you know. Barack
Obama.
Wait a minute, Ford. Gerald Ford. You know Gerald Ford's name just off the top of your head.
Yeah.
And David and Julie Eisenhower. You know
exactly.
All that stuff.
What's the clip we got here?
Our clip here is the Crow has emerged and has just blown up a pawn shop where that was sort of used as a front by the criminal organization, and he is being arrested apparently by the cop. The very cop who tried to investigate him a year ago. So this cop is now trying to arrest somebody who is dead.
Okay, this is from The Crow.
I thought the police always said freeze.
Well, I am the police. And I say don't move, Snow White. You move, you're dead.
And I say I'm dead. And I move.
Now, one more step. I'm serious.
Then shoot, if you will. Officer Albrecht.
What, are you nuts? Walking into a gun? You high?
You don't remember me.
Talking about?
How about Shelley? Do you remember Shelley Webster?
Shelley Webster is dead, my friend. I want you to move over to the curb there. Go on, run nice and easy. Come on, move it! No waiting for backup. It's getting too friggin' weird for me.
Oh, it gets better. Do you know someone named T-Bird? He had a friend who shouldn't have played with knives. Like the coat?
The guy that murdered Tintin.
He was already dead. He died a year ago, the moment he touched her. They're all dead. They just don't know it yet.
That's from The Crow. I gather this film pretty violent, as you
mentioned. It is violent, but it's violence. To be honest, it's violence with a purpose. It's not pornographic violence. It's not for its own sake. It's really pretty awesome.
I think that's the thing about these movies that's tricky is there's this fine line between the anti-hero and the fascist.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of revenge movies sort of play on the notion of the anti-hero because he's that person who acts out, you know, those deep-seated transgressive fantasies that we have, and he wants to make it right in the simplest, most direct way possible. And that's why, you know, sometimes this anti-hero thing degenerates into these fascist fantasies, and they become a lot less interesting, I think.
Hmm. Okay, that film is titled The Crow. We're talking about anti-hero movies. These are heroes and villains who are tarnished and flawed, who wind up doing the right thing, though sometimes for the wrong reason. If you want to join our conversation with your pick for a fine, good anti-hero film that maybe others might want to see, 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Mitch Bryan, tell us about a film that a lot of folks liked a whole lot, L.A. Confidential.
From 1997, based on James Ellroy's novel, part of his L.A. Quartet. And, you know, interestingly enough, it's this apparently unfilmable novel. If you were to pick it up and read it, it's got 8 or 9 major plots that interweave. And Ellroy himself was, I think, really impressed with the movie because director Curtis Hanson and screenwriter Brian Helgeland were able to distill this book down into sort of three characters all who come together on the same kind of plot trajectory. Mm. And in a way, it's a movie where you've got three anti-heroes for the price of one because all three of these guys, Ed Exley, Bud White, and Jack Vincennes, played by Russell Crowe, Kevin Spacey,
Guy Pearce,
whose name I just went out of my head. Sorry, it's no Tintin and Skank.
Star of Lockdown.
Yeah. play these three Los Angeles cops in the 1950s, each who sort of battling their own demons. In the case of Ed Exley, the Guy Pearce character, he's terribly ambitious. He's willing to rat out his fellow cops to get where he wants to go. You've got Jack Vincennes, played by Kevin Spacey, who is this guy who's a technical consultant on a Dragnet type show, who's on the take, willing to take money to sort of help a friend of his with a gossip magazine be able to make high profile busts. And then Russell Crowe, who's characterized as a mindless thug, playing this character Bud White, who is he's actually believed the press that he's much smarter than he, I think, allows himself to believe that he is, and who's willing to beat a confession out of a suspect if he needs to. So each one of these guys are flawed characters, mm-hmm. And yet through the course of this this terrible crime that they begin to investigate, each one sort of is allowed to use his strengths, as dark as they may be, to ultimately solve the crime, and it forms these really interesting alliances as the story goes on. Beautifully production designed, beautifully photographed, and really evokes that sort of 1950s Los Angeles crime mm-hmm. film. You know, it's a terrific movie, an epic movie. I mean, it's 2.5 hours long, and you just can sink into this picture.
Did it make money?
You know, it was not the big hit that everybody wanted.
But critics loved it. Yeah.
9 Academy Award nominations. I think that anybody who sees it is sort of captivated by it almost immediately. But somehow people didn't go out into the theaters and see it on its initial release.
You know, Russell Crowe, you mentioned, stars in this film. What's happened to him? You know, I haven't seen him in recent years in anything significant.
He's made some not great movies, The Next 3 Days and A Good Year. And
he had some personal stuff going on, I think.
There was talk of, I think he had an incident in L.A. where he banged a telephone off the head of some hapless concierge or something who couldn't complete his call to Australia. But, you know, the guy is an unbelievably talented actor.
Yeah.
I wouldn't imagine that we're too long from seeing him.
You know what happens, though, with a lot of these guys who become movie stars is that once that happens, there's this incredible pressure to push them through as many pictures as possible. And, you know, and they're making the big money. They're making the crazy money. Why not say yes to every job that comes your line? He formed a relationship with Ridley Scott, did several movies with him, some of, you know, which did better than others. And so, you know, it's just one of those deals where I certainly think we haven't seen the last of him. I mean, mm-hmm. he is a terrific actor.
I just hadn't heard his
classic
name for quite a while.
Classic Nicolas Cage syndrome.
Oh,
you gotta get those 8 movies out every year, and it doesn't matter what they are.
Is that what Nicolas
Cage has gone from the highs of Leaving Las Vegas to being in every dreadful,
Disney,
leaden lump of a screenplay that his agent just sneezes his way. I mean, I get that he has tax trouble. I get that, you know, he's blaming his accountant for, you know, having to give up his castle in France or his, you know, multiple homes in Baton Rouge, but the guy has just got to stop. I mean, I think it was like in 2003 that Ben Stiller was in 7 movies in 2003, and it was like, boy, is there such a thing as too much Ben Stiller? Yes, we learned that in 2003, but there's certainly such a thing as too
but
much
But that's
Ben
not – I don't know if that's the actor's job to make that decision, you know? I mean, if somebody's going to pay you to millions of dollars to be in their movie
– Can't you say
why
no?
Not? I don't know. Why not? I'd rather work than sit on the couch.
I mean, when they signed up B. Arthur for Harry and the Hendersons, that's all I'm saying is you can't say no.
What's the clip we have from L.A. Confidential?
This is a key moment for Ed Exley as he discusses with the Kevin Spacey character, Jack Vincennes, why he decided to become a cop.
Why in the world do you want to go digging any deeper into the Night Owl killings, Lieutenant?
Rollo Tomasi.
Is there more to that, or am I supposed to guess?
Rollo was a purse snatcher. My father ran into him off duty, and he shot my father 6 times and got away clean. No one even knew who he was. I just made the name up to give him some personality.
What's your point?
Rollo Tomasi's the reason I became a cop. I wanted to catch the guys who thought they could get away with it. Was supposed to be about justice. Then somewhere along the way, I lost sight of that. Why'd you become a cop?
I don't remember.
That's from L.A. Confidential. We're talking about great anti-hero movies with screenwriter and UMKC film prof Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck, a movie reviewer for Inc. magazine. If you have a recommendation for us, 816-235-2888. Let's go to some calls here. Mike from Baldwin City. Mike, good morning.
Thanks for taking my call. I want to suggest Viggo Mortensen in The History of Violence.
Absolutely.
A terrific pick.
Oh, yeah. He's this guy who is this insanely violent mob hitman, and he tries to reinvent himself in Indiana or somewhere. And he does something really heroic, and it puts him on the national TV again. And his mob buddies that he left after this one guy he mangled comes out there to Indiana and haunts him and tries to take him back to Philly to make him pay for his sins. He kills that guy in his yard, and then his people around him in Indiana are defending him, and then once they see how he handles these mobsters, they're afraid of him too, and he has to come to terms with the monster that he used to be and the fact that he can't live a double life anymore.
That's right. Classic anti-hero. You try and get your claw your way out and get pulled right back in.
I love the part at the end where his brother is trying to execute him for what he put his brother through, and he shoots his own brother.
Yeah. Mike, thank you. Good recommendation. Yeah. Let's go to Jeff from Blue Springs. Jeff, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Well, thanks.
I recently saw a movie, Chronicles of Riddick with Vin Diesel, and I thought that there were times where you could almost put hero in parentheses. This guy was so far away from hero, but I'm not a big Vin Diesel fan, but I thought the role he played was really good with the anti-hero part.
Riddick is a big anti-hero. You know, he's a lifetime criminal who happens to be strong and resourceful enough to help everybody else survive. But, of course, his own goal is his own survival. But I'd say Riddick is a terrific example of an anti-hero, actually.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Jeff, thank you. Steve from Lee's Summit. Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
And I'd like to hear comments on how the movie Apocalypse Now fits in with today's theme, and that would be the Martin Sheen character.
Boy, you know, in the history of my movie-going career, that movie hit me harder than anything I'd ever seen before. I just was absolutely drained after that film, Mitch.
Well, you know, Martin Sheen's character is ultimately an assassin, and there are a lot of anti-hero movies that deal with this notion of the hitman. You know, the man who takes the assignment, and over the course of the assignment to take somebody else's life, ultimately has to sort of take stock of who they are and decide whether they're going to go through with it or not. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of Apocalypse Now, whether he's actually going to take over the power that he could potentially inherit if he executes Colonel Kurtz. It's a tried and true archetypical pattern in these anti-hero movies.
Yeah. Steve, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Let's grab one more before a break here. Jason Heck from Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah, from another James Ellroy novel. no, this is actually a terrific movie. It's a great mashup of two very different kinds of movies. It's directed by Robert Rodriguez back in 1996, written by Quentin Tarantino. It tells the story of Seth and Richard Gecko, played by George Clooney and Quentin Tarantino, who are a pair of brothers, and they are career criminals. They are bank robbers. And they go on this murder spree as they rob a bank in Wichita and head south through Oklahoma and Texas. And they end up killing, a dozen law officers and five Texas Rangers. Their goal is to get to Mexico, to sanctuary. And they end up taking hostages in the form of Harvey Keitel as Jacob Fuller, a priest who's lost his faith, and his daughter, Juliette Lewis, and his adopted son, played by a kid named Ernest Liu. And they take their RV south. And it's a road picture, basically, until they end up at a bar, who shall go unnamed for purposes of public radio decency. And turns out that the bar is fully staffed and run by vampires. And so the road picture turns into a vampire picture. And I know it sounds stupid, audience. I know that. It is, in fact, unbelievably energetic. It has this sort of let them eat trash genre vibe. It is really muscular. It is the parts, because Tarantino does the dialogue, the dialogue is much better than a movie that you would think this sort should have. The cast is actually kind of incredible because both Rodriguez and Tarantino are movie geeks. So we have small roles played by John Hawkes, who is this liquor store clerk at the beginning. The old cadaverous Hollywood character actor Mark Lawrence has a teeny tiny role as a motel owner. John Saxon shows up as an FBI agent. Fred Williamson. Special effects genius Tom Savini plays
Fred
a biker.
Fred Williamson, the Hammer.
Fred the Hammer. Hammer.
Custody Chief.
Yeah.
That's right. And Tom Savini, who plays a biker named Sex Machine. Basically, it turns into this fight for survival in the bar as our cast is slowly whittled down by the vampires, who are mostly strippers and bartenders and bouncers. It's inventive. It's funny. It doesn't pause for breath. It sweeps you along, and it is the first role for George Clooney coming out of ER, and he hits
really?
This one out of the park. He's really great. His mannerisms that were on display as Dr. Doug Ross, principally the head tilt and the smirk, are not really on display here. He is intense. He's given good dialogue, and he delivers it very well. And
what role does he have?
He plays Seth Gecko. He plays kind of the more rational of the two brothers. Tarantino plays his brother Richie, who turns out to be a bit of a depraved sex fiend and who has more than a few issues. But Seth is a career criminal. He is the kind of guy who lives by a code. He doesn't kill people that he doesn't have to. There is no sadism in what he does. If you're standing between him and his goal, you'll probably get blown away. But he is that very typical career criminal, the guy who, you know, populates Michael Mann movies by and large. His, you know, it's his job. He takes it very seriously. He's good at it. And that's that.
What was his breakout role then following this film?
This honestly was pretty good. In 97, he did this sort of forgettable action thing with Nicole Kidman called The Peacemaker, I believe. Peacemaker. And then he killed the Batman franchise with the help of Joel Schumacher and Arnold as Mr. Freeze.
What do you mean he killed the Batman franchise?
He even copped to it, actually, in an interview. He said, they had this franchise that made $1 billion and I killed it. It was just Joel Schumacher took it so far into camp that audiences kind of recoiled and realized that it was way too campy, that Adam West should be Adam West and the bat suit shouldn't have nipples on it. And it was way too over the top. You had Arnold as Mr. Freeze and you had Uma as Poison Ivy,
yeah,
and it was too
much. Okay. What's the clip we have here from Dusk Till Dawn?
It's right toward the beginning of the movie when Seth and Richie have seized a bank teller for a hostage, this sort of nice middle school mom looking kind of lady, and Seth is giving her a bit of a speech about how to behave when she's a hostage. There are a couple of nasty words that we edited out, so you'll hear some weird cuts there.
We need to have a talk. What's your name?
Gloria.
Hello, Gloria. I'm Seth. That's my brother, Richie. Let's cut to the chase. I'm going to ask you one question, and all I want is a yes or no answer. Do you want to live through this?
Yes.
Good. Rule number one, no noise. No questions. If you make a noise, Mr. 44 makes a noise. If you ask a question, Mr. 44 answers it. Now, are you absolutely, positively clear about rule number one?
Yes.
Rule number two. You do what we say when we say it. If you don't, see rule number one. Rule number three, don't you ever try and run on us. Because I got six little friends, and they can all run faster than you can. Gloria, you hang in there, you follow the rules, and you don't f*** with us, and you'll get out of this alive. I give you my word. Okay?
Man.
Vintage Steve Kraske right there.
Yeah, yeah.
How many interviews
have you
scored?
Do you want to live through this?
Right.
I need to ask that question as we start most of the interviews.
Your interview with Dr. Wheeler that began that way was one of the most shocking and harrowing interviews in your long and storied career.
Okay, we're through 3 of 6 here on Up to Date. We're talking great anti-hero films. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. Coming up in our second half, we'll talk about The Watchmen, Man on Fire, and Donnie Darko. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.
I know what you're thinking. Did he fire 6 shots or only 5? Well, to tell you the truth, I forgot myself in all this excitement. But being as this is the .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and it could blow your head clean off, you have to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
And how many times as kids do we imitate that lines of dialogue from Clint Eastwood? That was from
Dirty Harry.
Dirty Harry, okay.
You told me that was Corey Flintoff. I thought.
Not quite.
Okay. All right.
But how many times we imitate that? Like, do you feel lucky? You know, just what a voice, what a guy. We're talking about anti-hero films, of which Clint Eastwood embodies that stereotype, that role, very often in several of his films, including A Fistful of Dollars and Dirty Harry. If you want to join our conversation here as we talk about anti-hero films, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Let's go to some folks who have been waiting for a bit with their recommendations for good anti-hero films. Ken from Roland Park, good morning.
Good morning. Hey, guys. Really love the show today.
Thanks.
And I'm excited to hear you guys talk about Man on Fire, one of my top five favorite shows. But I was thinking, you know, pound for pound, arguably one of the best actors in Hollywood, Nicolas Cage, I know you guys love him, in a comedy, Raising Arizona, an anti-hero figure steals the baby, gets the baby back, does it for love of his wife. And so anyhow, you guys have been talking about this death and destruction and mayhem, but I thought I'd bring a comedy into the conversation.
I would say that H.I. McDonough is a pretty good anti-hero, actually. I mean, you know, he does it for selfish reasons to, you know, keep his marriage together and make his wife happy, and he does good things for the baby because he realizes how wrong it is.
Almost all of the Coen Brothers movies have anti-heroes at the center of them, whether it's Burn After Reading or Blood Simple.
Or The Big Lebowski.
The Dude, one of the
great modern anti-heroes. So, yeah, we actually talked about The Dude a little bit, and I debated doing it for the show, but I would say that High is a pretty great example.
Good example and a smart man. When mom ain't happy, ain't nobody happy.
That's exactly right. We're such pop here, huh?
Ken, thank you very much. Let's go to Gene from Fairway. Gene, nice to have you.
Well, thank you for taking my call. And I just wanted to comment on one that was kind of overlooked for 2010. It was 310 to Yuma with
Russell
Crowe. Oh, great flick. Great Western flick with Russell Crowe and Christian Bale. But it was a remake of one made in the 40s with Van Heflin and Ford.
Glenn Ford,
exactly. But the dialogue stayed pretty much the same because the dialogue was great. And same kind of crackling theme, but I thought it was interesting that they gave Christian Bale a limp and kind of had him even more of a sympathetic character in the remake. But great Westerns all the way. And thank you guys for your comments on movies.
Gene, thank you. Again, we're talking anti-heroes, people who do the right thing, though sometimes for the wrong reason. John from Kansas City, Missouri, good morning. You there,
Hello?
John? Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, yeah, my name is John. I can't believe y'all haven't brought up Cool Hand Luke. That's the ultimate anti-hero move.
Yeah, you know, the thing about Cool Hand Luke is you're right. And Paul Newman excelled at these sort of HUD being another example of these characters who are kind of despicable on one level. In some ways, he's more lovable in Cool Hand Luke than most. He definitely gets himself into jail by doing something as ridiculous as knocking the heads off of parking meters.
But
he becomes a Christ figure by the end of that movie. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
John,
yeah,
good.
To me, that's like the ultimate, the epitome of the, you know, the anti-social.
Right.
But in a good way that you can, you know, that he never hurt anyone, you know, mainly just himself, and then he inspired others.
Right.
To the point that, you know, that movie was so, John Mellencamp even named two of his sons after characters in that movie.
Wow. John, thank you for that phone call.
My
thanks for the good
line.
Trivia here, too. Mitch Bryan, tell us about the film Watchmen.
You know, Watchmen is a polarizing film. People seem to either love it or hate it. I keep thinking every time that I watch it again, I'm going to see the light and I'm going to hate the movie. But I don't. I unapologetically love Watchmen. It's a flawed film, no doubt about it. There are things about it that I think could be better, and certainly a movie that could be shorter. But As the Avengers comes out, you know, this weekend, and you see this group of of caped superheroes in a group together, you know, posing. I always think about The Watchmen because The Watchmen is really the flip side of the superhero. It's the movie, it's the graphic novel that takes all of the assumptions about the superhero to their logical conclusions, including, for example, the fact that you know, these people that dress up in suits and go out at night to try and solve crime, you know, in a vigilante fashion, mm-hmm. is a pretty fascist notion. The notion that if we had somebody with superpowers, all powerful superpowers like a Superman, well, why wouldn't we use him if we were at war to win the war? Which, of course, they do in Watchmen. Watchmen takes place in an alternative history in 1985, where, among other things, Richard Nixon is still the president. Where superheroes have reached a point where they've been declared illegal because they're essentially fascists in suits going out trying to do the job of the law enforcement agencies, except for a couple of instances. One, a character called the Comedian, who is used for dark, nefarious work by CIA and groups like that. And then this character, Dr. Manhattan, who is essentially Superman, who has more or less put all the superheroes out of business because he's the real deal. He's got real superpowers. He can transport himself through time and space. He can grow to the size of a skyscraper. And the narrative of the thing has to do with the fact that one by one, these retired superheroes are being murdered. And the question is, who's killing them? Why are they being killed? And it sort of falls to a guy called Rorschach, who's the one vigilante superhero who has not retired, to try to put this case together and figure out, you know, he's probably on the list himself, who's killing off the famous ex-superheroes. I think it's a visually stunning movie. It's just and the way that the music interplays with it. It was directed by Zack Snyder, who made 300, who really called in a lot of his chips, I think, after 300 and Dawn of the Dead, the remake, which have both been very successful pictures. And he gets the studio to make one of the most expensive action movies that's based on, you know, an obscure graphic novel that's been in development for 20 years, that's dark, that's R-rated, that has everything about it that really is not what's supposed to be part of the user-friendly summer blockbuster. And I sort of admire the movie for that alone, you know?
What's the clip we have here from Watchmen?
So here's a scene early on between the old Night Owl from the old group of superheroes talking to his newer incarnation about how this all came about.
It all started with the gangs. You know, people tend to forget that. Pirate outfits, ghosts. They thought it was funny. Dress up and pull heists. Of course, as soon as we arrest them, they'd be back on the street again. Nobody could pick them out of the lineup because of the damn masks. So, a few of us cops, we get together and we figure, what the heck? We'll mask up too. We'll finish what the law couldn't. Pretty soon, papers get wind of it, they ran with it, and oh boy, we're a national pastime. It was me, Dollar Bill, Mothman, Captain Metropolis, Hooded Justice, Silk Spectre, and the Comedian. No, don't get me started on him. I must be drunk already, telling you this sob story again.
I think you were trying to make a point.
Well, my point is that we had it too easy. It wasn't fair what happened to you guys. You guys who picked up where we left off, with Nixon forcing you out. Nixon, oh, that prick. And to think I voted for that prick 5 times.
Hey, it was him with the commies, right?
That's from Watchmen.
The fifth Nixon term.
Nixon's fifth term.
Wow.
Now there's America for you.
Nixon's the one.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Recommendations for great anti-hero movies. Chris from Kearney, good morning. You there, Chris? Let's go to Ron from Kansas City, Kansas. Ron, good to have you.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, thanks, Ron.
Okay, I've got two. One is Lonely or the Brave with Kirk Douglas. And another one is
Lots of nodding of heads here, Ron.
And Hard Times with Charles Bronson. And both of them, I just think I could go to a desert island with those two movies. And great cast in both of them.
Tell us about the Bronson film, Hard Times.
It's got James Coburn in it, Strother Martin, yeah. And it's Depression time, and he's called a hitter. And basically he goes to these places and fights for bets and money, but it's bare-knuckled fighting and just, I don't know, it's one of those movies I caught on the Late Show years ago when there used to be a Late Show, and it just knocked me out. Just a great movie.
Yeah, Ron, thanks. You know, and Charles Bronson sort of overlooked in many ways in movie history. He was sort of a presence when I was a kid, and you don't hear much about him anymore.
And then certainly with the Death Wish movies, he really did become the ultimate anti-hero. Mm-hmm. And those films would get bigger and dumber and louder as they went on and uglier too. You know, so mm-hmm. he was a strange guy. He was very self contained. You know, he was from a coal mining background.
In real life.
Yeah. Bashinsky, I think was his last name really. And but yeah, certainly with Hard Times, Walter Hill's first directing gig, it's an amazing, tough, wonderful movie. And James Coburn is hilarious in it, and Strother Martin is wonderful.
Strother Martin's always great.
Yeah, Strother Martin's
We're taking
great.
Your recommendations for great anti-hero films. 816-235-2888, our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Okay, Jason Heck, up next with Man on Fire. Tell me it's
the
not
Steve
true.
Kraske story.
Yes.
No, Man on Fire is a really, really interesting movie to me. It's based on a novel by A.J. Quinnell that he wrote in 1981. It was set, the novel was actually first filmed in 1983 with Scott Glenn in our hero role of former CIA man John Creasy. And the original was set in Italy when the Red Brigades were causing so much havoc with terrorism and kidnapping people. And kidnappings were very common. Well, in 2004, kidnappings have pretty much gotten under control under the Berlusconi administration. So we move it to Mexico. And the movie has a lot of title cards flashing up to give you information. And one of them at the beginning says that there's a kidnapping every 60 minutes in Latin America. So if you're going to live in Mexico City and be rich, you need to have a kidnapping insurance policy, which evidently is a real life thing, for $10 million or something. But to get that policy, you need to have a bodyguard. So we have Mark Anthony playing Samuel Ramos, a young businessman, and his beautiful wife, Lisa, played by the lovely Radha Mitchell, a woman who keeps responding to my Valentine's with restraining orders, bless her heart. I framed them all. They're all framed, Radha. And we have John Creasy, played by Denzel Washington, who does haunted-looking men of action better than almost anybody. And if you look in Inside Man, if you look in anything, he does this sort of world-weary thing very, very well. He is a man who was elite. He was was long-range reconnaissance and CIA and Foreign Legion and paratroopers, and he comes cheap because he's a drunk. And he is recommended for the part by his former CIA buddy Paul Rayburn, played by Christopher Walken, who now runs a security consulting business in Mexico. He is put in charge of the security of a charming little girl named Pita, who is played by Dakota Fanning, the precocious little child star. And, of course, a kidnapping does occur. And he makes a vow that he is going to kill every single person who was involved with the kidnapping or profited from it in any way. And he proceeds to use his undeniably lethal skill set to cut a swath right up the chain of command through corrupt cops, through nightclubs, through it works his way pretty high up and to get the little girl back. It was done by Tony Scott, Ridley Scott's brother, who is a man who is much more enamored of style. And it has... It is quick cuts and oversaturated colors and a lot of shaky cam. The style can get a little bit tedious because in some scenes it's really for its own sake. But the plot is actually really gripping. Watching Denzel slowly uncoil all of his inner resources and his inner strength and find this sense of purpose to go on. And this is a great anti-hero mission to slaughter a dozen people on behalf of a little girl. So it's actually a really engrossing, really grabby movie. The Mexico City locations are lush and beautiful and urban and dangerous feeling. And I think it's a great flick.
And what's the clip we have from Man on Fire?
We have Christopher Walken in the hospital talking with Mexican cop Giancarlo Giannini, which is why you'll hear a sort of raspy Italian-accented voice. And he is explaining to Giannini exactly what John Creasy is and why it's best to stay out of his way.
Peter Ramos. It's a number to you, you know. One more dead, but a number.
What was she to Crazy then?
She showed him it was all right to live again.
And the kidnappers took that away, huh?
And they're gonna wish they never touched a hair on her head. A man can be an artist. And anything, food, whatever. It depends on how good he is at it. Creasy's art is death. He's about to paint his masterpiece.
Very tough words.
Going to be a lot of blood red in that palette, let me tell you. And brain matter gray.
That's where we're going with Man on Fire. Okay, let's go to some phone calls here and go to Heidi with her pick for great anti-hero films. Heidi, good morning. You there, Heidi? She was going to pick A Perfect World with Kevin Costner from 93.
Movie I like a lot. I don't know that I would view him necessarily as an anti-hero. I can see a little bit in how he sort of he takes a little boy hostage and ends up sort of doing the right thing for the boy. But, yeah, I certainly love that movie. Eastwood is very hit and miss with me, and that was definitely one of his hits.
Melissa from Overland Park. Melissa, hi.
Hi. My recommendation would be Mystery Men, a great comedy from the 90s with Ben Stiller and Janine Garofalo. They're in it, and they actually wrote it. And it's this great send-up of what it is to be a superhero, and Stiller plays the quintessential anti-hero that, he obviously, you still love him, though, because it's a big satire.
All right. He plays Phoenix Dirk Dark, the a.k.a. Mr. Furious. I the movie was a bomb at the box office, and I don't think it really deserved it. It was a little hard for audiences to approach, but I love
that
movie.
Yeah, it's very funny.
I love it.
Melissa with Mystery Men from 1999, and Mitch Bryan is here with a film, Donnie Darko, to wrap things up today.
Which is maybe an odd choice, but I think in terms of Donnie Darko being a character who certainly transgresses and does a lot of wrong things and ultimately does the right thing in the end, it's a great overview of sort of teenage angst. Jake Gyllenhaal plays this guy who is a troubled young man, and one day an airplane engine falls out of the sky into his bedroom, and if he had been home, it would have killed him. And he is being plagued by these visions of doom to come, and he's being manipulated by a fantasy friend who is a giant bunny with a skull face who named Frank who appears to him and helps him figure out what he needs to do from day to day.
Tough movie to summarize.
Yeah, it's a really hard movie. It's about time, space, continuum. It's about time travel. It's about adolescent angst. And it's a really unusual movie. I don't know that I totally understand the film, and I've seen it several times. But it's so filled with interesting performances and beautiful moody ideas, and it's a mind bender of a movie. You know, it's not perfect, and that's what makes it so wonderful. Is that it has all these sort of weird corners and weird shadows to it.
How's Jake in this film?
He's really good. I mean, he's it's all a very understated performance. You know, but he's clearly the anchor of the movie, and that's what makes it so interesting.
And he's the great anti-hero in this film. Why, Mitch?
Well, because he gets up to doing things like burning down somebody's house and flooding his school and
flooding
not,
his school?
Flooding his school.
How does he do that?
He breaks the pipes open and floods the school.
There you go.
He's driven by these sort of dark impulses, he's very much an anti-hero, but not in the way we normally would assume.
We have a clip here from Donnie Darko.
Yeah, in this scene, he has been hypnotized by his therapist, played by Catherine Ross, and he's discussing his sort of tortured state of mind.
Okay.
What did you want for Christmas that year?
Hungry, hungry hippos.
How did you feel being denied these hungry, hungry hippos?
Regret.
What else makes you feel regret?
That I did it again.
You did it again?
I flooded my school and I burned down that pervert's house. I only have a few days left before they catch me.
Did Frank tell you to do these things?
I have to obey him. He saved my life. I have to obey him or I'll be left all alone. And then... and then I won't be able to figure out what this is all about. I won't be able to know his master plan.
That's from Donnie Darko. Okay. One more call here from Drew from Olathe. Drew, welcome to the show. You there, Drew? He was going to say, bring me the head of Alfredo Garcia.
Yeah,
for 1970. Tell us about that.
That's such a great movie. Warren Oates plays a down on his luck ne'er-do-well who is ultimately involved in a plot to try to retrieve the head of a guy who has been had a bounty put on him by a Mexican crime lord. And he eventually does get the head. And it becomes a road trip with him and the head in a bag, and he talks to the head all through the movie, and shoots a lot of people on the way. And it's a I'm selling it short because it really is one of Sam Peckinpah's greatest movies.
Jason Heck, thanks so much.
You're welcome, buddy.
That's Jason Heck, Mitch Bryan. Yeah. Thank you guys for coming in. Good to have you both. Yeah, see you next time, guys. And this is from Eastwood.
Yes, for Fistful of Dollars, or for a few dollars more. Sorry.
Okay. You'll find Mitch and Jason's DVD picks and trailers of the films we talked about today, as well as their bios, much more, a whole lot more, at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. If you're looking for a great movie to see on the big screen this weekend, check out our film critics' three to see, their favorite independent foreign and documentary films now showing at area theaters. Monday on the program, a good one, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Anna Quinlan is here. We'll talk about her new memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. We had help this week from KCUR's Danny Alexander, Maria Carter, and Kim Noble. The show is produced by Steven Steigman. And a very special thank you to intern Kathleen Pointer, who leaves us today. Kathleen was an invaluable part of this show over the last 5 months. Thank you, Kathleen, and have a blast in Paris. Write us often. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date. Wait tonight. Wait tonight.